First, we will hear from Dr. Jim Rice. Dr. Rice is an environmental scientist specializing in contaminant transport and source identification, read across assessment, and the evaluation of organic compound contaminants. He applies his expertise to environmental cost allocation, site remediation, groundwater assessment, insurance cost recovery, litigation support, and chemical compliance. Before joining Gradient, he was a postdoctoral research associate and state agency liaison at the Brown University SRP Center, where he served as a knowledge broker between the Brown SRP Center and its government and business stakeholders. During his doctoral and postdoctoral work, Dr. Rice evaluated the thermodynamics and phase behavior of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon mixtures and used Pavlov samplers to monitor petroleum hydrocarbons in an oil-contaminated river. He received his PhD in chemical engineering and Master of Science in Engineering from Brown University and his BS in chemical engineering from Northeastern University. Dr. Rice, I'll now turn it over to you.
Great. Thanks, Brittany. I'd also like to thank the NIHS Superfund Research Program for inviting me to speak today. I'm going to be discussing a project that involved tailoring read-across methodology for TSCA and other contexts. But first, I'd like to recognize two important collaborators, gradient toxicologists Tom Lewandowski and Joel Cohen. And I'd like to highlight the importance of the collaboration between both chemists and toxicologists. I think this project really serves as a model of sorts for new approach methodologies, or NAMs, that really encourage or even necessitate interdisciplinary collaboration. So I'll set the stage a bit by providing an overview on TSCA and its 2016 reform. So TSCA is the Toxic Substances Control Act. It was passed in the United States in 1976. It governs non-food, non-drug chemicals, and a few things that it did do, it established an inventory of chemicals in commerce or production. It also established notification requirements, such as pre-manufacturing notices or significant new use notices. And it allowed for the possibility of restriction of harmful chemicals. What it didn't have was significant testing and data requirements. Now, for a bit of context here, I have a photo of the Cray-1 supercomputer that was also released in 1976. It weighed over 5 tons, and it was able to process 160 million floating point operations per second. And like the Cray-1 supercomputer, TSCA was really groundbreaking in 1976. But as we move to the 2000s, decades later, We see that TSCA really was becoming obsolete. And again, for point of context, here I have an iPhone 7 that was released in 2016. It only weighed 6.6 ounces, and that is just a very small fraction of the weight of the Cray-1 supercomputer. Its processing capability was also orders of magnitude greater. And so this analogy is just meant to sort of highlight or illustrate the fact that a technical regulation really may be outmoded by the 2000s, and in fact, TSCA was. EPA's authority was really limited and passive, and the inventory that I mentioned on the last slide was outdated. And TSCA didn't account for novel new materials, such as nanomaterials, and manufacturers were facing variable regulations across multiple jurisdictions. So this really was the impetus for the 2016 TSCA reform, which is also known as the Frank R. Lautenberg Chemical Safety Act for the 21st Century. I'm sorry, for the 21st Century Act. I'll refer to this as LOXA or TSCA reform in the following slides. So under LOXA, EPA now has much more authority to evaluate and manage chemical risks. Manufacturers are required to provide enough information for EPA to definitively determine if a chemical presents an unreasonable risk. But overall, the data required is unclear. We do know that EPA is prioritizing non-vertebrate testing. In fact, the strategic plan for this is due out on June 22, 2018, and there's a draft plan available on the web that was released in March 2018. In terms of existing chemicals, EPA is prioritizing them, and high-priority chemicals will require further risk evaluation. EPA must complete prioritization and designate 10 high and 20 low priority chemicals by December of 2019. And in fact, 10 risk evaluations for high priority chemicals are, sorry, something just popped up on my screen there, okay. So in fact, 10 risk evaluations for high priority chemicals started in 2016, and 10 more are to begin no later than December 2019. And if a chemical is found to be unreasonable risky, it must be managed with use restrictions or other risk management measures. What this all boils down to is that manufacturers now must provide substantial data prior to a chemical registration and sale, and this data must be, quote, consistent with the best available science. So this really begs the question, what does this mean? What's the best available science? We all know that the gold standard here in terms of toxicological information is evidence from human exposure or animal tox studies. But there's a fair amount of uncertainty about new approach methodologies, such as in vitro, QSAR, and read-across methodologies. In other words, the extent that EPA will prefer and accept these data in lieu of animal testing is still unclear. What is clear is that animal testing isn't the answer moving forward. Animal testing is extremely time-consuming. A 90-day tox study can take over a year from inception to report, and a two-year cancer bioassay can take up to 5 years. Of course, animal testing is expensive. Full tox packages can cost millions of dollars, and they're wasteful and ethically challenging. They involve hundreds of animals, and in many cases, the data are similar to existing data for related chemicals. And I think we all know that tox testing is also imperfect. The data require a fair amount of extrapolation, and they're not always informative about why toxicity is occurring. But of course, there are challenges in implementing new methods. So first, there's need for acceptance here. We're used to animal testing. It's the status quo. It's what we trust and what we're comfortable with. We also want to avoid treating alternatives as an add-on rather than a replacement. In other words, we don't want to give ourselves more work here. We want to eventually transition from animal studies to alternatives. There are challenges in data interpretation, and I think maybe most importantly, there's need for standardization. There are many alternative assays and programs that talented researchers all over the world are working on, and of course, regulators just can't know them all. There's also need for flexibility, and this will sort of be a theme for the rest of the presentation. Justification for use of these alternative methods really has to be context specific. As an example, ECHA, or the European Chemicals Agency, has published read-across guidance that requires extensive justification, and we think that this may not be appropriate for all situations where read-across is used or required. In other words, decision context is very important. Product safety is more than chemical registration, and different applications may require different levels of effort and justification. Gradient is now working on projects related to drug and chemical development and product impurity assessment, in addition to alternatives assessment, where some toxicological data is extremely informative despite there being no immediate need for any chemical registration or any large-scale chemical registration. As an example of this, we're working with wearable electronics manufacturers whose products come in close contact with people's skin. And we've assessed the sensitization potential of thousands, I should say the sensitization and irritation potential of thousands of chemicals to date. And for those that aren't familiar with sensitization, it's an allergic skin response. It's a bit different than irritation. And to do this assessment, we developed and validated a read-across framework to fill dermal sensitization and irritation gaps. And it's this validation of the framework that I'll be discussing in the following slides. I should take a step back and define read-across for those that are not familiar with it. It's a technique or a new alternative methodology, or excuse me, a new approach methodology where properties of a known beta-rich chemical that we refer to as a surrogate or an analog are read across or transferred to a new data-poor chemical. So for the remainder of the presentation, I'm going to focus on a case study in which we explored the utility of endpoint-specific read-across tools. And it's important to point out that Gradient actually uses these tools to fill sensitization data gaps. So to do this case study, we established a set of 28 chemicals that are structurally similar to a target chemical, in this case, a hypothetical target chemical, hydroxyethyl acrylate. Now, we know based on animal test data that hydroxyethyl acrylate is in fact a skin sensitizer. It's well studied. But typically we don't know that for a target chemical. A target chemical is usually data poor. So we basically are going to kind of put the blinders on here and pretend that we don't know that this chemical or this target chemical is a sensitizer. And the bin here with 28 additional chemicals can be seen as a list of potential surrogates. Now, I also want to mention that this is one of three case studies, and the full story for all three was just recently published in April of this year in ACS Sustainable Chemistry and Engineering. So the numbered list here is sort of a outline for the rest of the talk. We're going to discuss evaluating chemical structural similarity, consider structure activity relationship alerts, we'll bring in physical chemical properties, and finally determine read-across accuracy. So first off, chemical structural similarity. So we evaluate chemical structural similarity using two programs, ChemMine and ToxMatch. These programs explore and quantify similarity between chemical structures of paired molecules. And to do this, they enumerate structural features and subsequently calculate a similarity score known as a Tanimoto coefficient. Tanimoto coefficient is essentially a proportion of structural features common to both compounds divided by the total number of features. And what this means is that the scores range from 0 to 1, with 1 being the most similar. So the most important thing to know here is that these programs and others fingerprint molecules differently, and this can lead to discordant Tanimoto coefficients. And some time ago, maybe 2 years ago or so, Tom was working in our Seattle office, and Joel and I think were in the Boston office, and we were comparing some similarity scores over email, and we all ended up on the phone because our similarity scores were different, and we didn't quite know what was going on. And of course, we determined that we were using different programs, and then it sort of begged the question, well, what's going on here? Is one program better than the other? Is one of us right and one of us wrong? And so we took on a little endeavor here to sort of compare evaluation tools. And I'm going to discuss that in a second, but I also want to take a step back here just to say that we're doing two things in the following slides, including this one. First, we're trying to find suitable surrogates for our target chemical. But at the same time, we're evaluating the utility of the tools that we use to do this. Okay, so I'll walk through this relatively slowly. If we look at the table here, see if I can make this work. Okay, so the top row has our target chemical in it, hydroxyethyl acrylate, and then the bottom three rows include three of our test set chemicals. Now, I can't show all 28, so this is just a subset of the 28. And what you see in the columns to the right are ChemMine and ToxMatch similarity scores for each of these three potential surrogates. And what is obvious is that the ChemMine score is consistently smaller than the ToxMatch score. Now, before I get into that, I want to just say that we're looking for surrogates that have higher similarity scores. So based on the similarity score, something like ethyl acrylate, which has a ChemMine score of 0.4, looks better to us than this glycol monopropyl ether, which has a ChemMine similarity score of 0.14. now, that sort of takes care of the question of, you know, how do we find a suitable surrogate? But if we evaluate the tools we're using, we have to try to understand why these programs are performing differently. Well, the answer is that they fingerprint molecules differently. And to see what was happening here, we ordered our test set chemicals from most similar to least similar, so from 1 to 0, for both ChemMine and ToxMatch. And then we compared this rank order using the Kendall's coefficient of concordance, and what we found is that despite variation in similarity squared value, the similarity rank order determined by the two programs demonstrated agreement. So the take-home message here is that both programs are performing fine, they're sufficient, but the results from the two programs should not be used together. Okay, so that was kind of a snippet into how we evaluate chemical structural similarity, but we take another step and we evaluate structure, or we assess structure activity relationship alerts, and that's the next part of the talk here. So we use two SAR programs, ToxTree and Derek Nexus. ToxTree is a freely available program and Derek Nexus is a license-based product, but both of these products predict health endpoints, or both of these softwares, I should say, predict health endpoints of chemicals based on their structures. And so, again, we're doing two things here. We're trying to find suitable surrogates, but we're also evaluating the SAR tools. So, similar table here. We have our target chemical in the top row, and then three potential surrogates in the bottom three rows. And what we have here in these sort of two middle columns are the alerts from ToxTree and Derek Nexus. And we see that for hydroxyethyl acrylate, the target chemical, both ToxTree and Derek Nexus trigger alerts. So basically those programs are saying, hey, we think that this compound is a potential sensitizer. Now, in terms of finding a suitable surrogate, we're going to look for chemicals in our list that also trigger sensitization alerts. So ethyl acrylate and tetraethylene glycol diacrylate both look pretty good here to us, right? They both trigger the same alerts in ToxTree and Derek Nexus. So we actually would consider bringing those in as suitable surrogates. We would not consider the ethylene glycol monopropyl ether here at the bottom of the table because it does not trigger the same alerts as the target chemical. So separate from this, we can also take a look at how these programs are performing. So in some situations, the alert, so the yes is here, accurately predicts sensitization if we look at the animal test data. Similarly, for the ethylene glycol monopropyl ether in the bottom of the table, both ToxTree and Derek Nexus are accurately predicting non-sensitization. But the programs are not foolproof. So this middle compound here, tetraethylene glycol diacrylate, triggers alerts, but the animal test data show that it's a non-sensitizer. And so we can look at the statistics here for the full 28 chemical test set to sort of see how our programs are performing overall. And if you focus first on the two top pie charts, what we're showing here in blue is the true positive rate. That's a hazard being present and an alert also being present. And what this is illustrating is that both ToxTree and Derek Nexus are accurately predicting hazard 94% of the time for the 28 chemical test set. And this is a really reassuring result for us. What's not so reassuring is the true negative rate shown in the bottom two pie charts. So what we're showing here in blue in these are instances of a hazard not being present and an alert not being present. So ToxTree and Derek Nexus are only accurately predicting non-sensitization 54 and 69% of the time. Now, if we look at the red pieces of these bottom pie charts, what we're showing here is when a hazard is not present and an alert is present. basically what we're showing are false positives here. So the upside to this result is that it's conservative. We're over-predicting sensitization. In other words, it's health protective. If you're designing a product, if you're a manufacturer designing a product, you may not want to market something that triggers an alert, even knowing that that alert could be a false positive in some cases. This, of course, would give you some sense of comfort in product development. The point here really is to say that these SAR alerts or these SAR tools are a good screening tool, but not necessarily a silver bullet in terms of their ability to predict sensitization. So finally, we're going to bring in physical chemical property information and calculate read-across accuracy for our approach. So I'm not a toxicologist, I'm a chemist, but I am sort of showing here this adverse outcome pathway for skin sensitization that we developed, or we developed the image, I should say, not the pathway. And the point of showing this is really to say that during the induction phase, a chemical's ability to penetrate the skin and eventually induce sensitization is based on a chemical's structure and its physical chemical properties. In other words, if something is extremely volatile, it might evaporate quickly off the skin and not cause a reaction. Whereas, you know, something that's very lipophilic might be likely to absorb into the skin versus something that's much more water soluble. And so what we did was refine our surrogate selection approach by considering physical chemical data related to the AOP. And we combined this with information from the SAR alerts and the similarity scores that we talked about in previous slides. So we include chemicals that are similar in terms of molecular weight, aqueous solubility, and vapor pressure. And we only include chemicals whose chemline similarity score is greater than 0.1 and whose SAR alerts whose SAR alerts in toxicity and indirect nexus match those of the target chemical. So we're only including chemicals that trigger SAR alerts in both toxicity and indirect nexus, which is consistent with the target. What happens here is our number of proposed surrogates decreases from 28 to 11. And if we define read-across accuracy as animal toxicity data for surrogate chemicals accurately predicting sensitization hazard of the target chemical, we see that for our original test set, 15 of the 28 chemicals, or only 54% of them, are accurately matching the hazard of the target chemical. But for our refined test set, all 11 of the chemicals, so 100%, are accurately matching the hazard. So what this all boils down to is that endpoint-specific read-across can be used to bolster product safety evaluations and even chemical registration when multiple tools and information sources are carefully implemented to fill data gaps. As we just saw, physical chemical properties can improve the accuracy of the read-across approach greatly. Robust chemical read-across is not necessarily one-size-fits-all, and agencies developing read-across or NAM guidance should consider that these approaches can be tailored to specific criteria and needs. Finally, we think that maybe it's this type of support that we show in the case study that would help justify read-across for chemical registration via TSCA in the United States or similar regulatory schemes in other jurisdictions. So these slides will be posted, and I will leave references and resources. There are, of course, many others that are available, but I do want to highlight the paper here from ACS Sustainable Chemistry and ACS Sustainable Chemistry and Engineering that has sort of a more full version of the information presented today. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your interest and attention. My contact information is here, but Probably more importantly, Gradient's website and a link to our careers page is also available here. So we are recruiting, and we keep our website up to date with open positions. So if you're graduating soon or you just have graduated and you're looking for jobs in this area, please do check it out. You can email our Human Resources Department with questions, or you can even contact me through my email or through LinkedIn. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Rice. Just a reminder, if you guys have any questions, please submit them to the Q&A pod. We're going to start off with this first question that came in. What is the animal assay, for example, LLNA or GPMT, and what if only one is positive? How is that figured in?
That's a good question. So guinea pig, so like, this is where I'm not a toxicologist here. I am not 100% sure on LLNA, but GP is a guinea pig study. Can you hear me?
Jim, are you still on the line? Yep.
Yep, I'm still here. Was there more to that question?
Okay. Nope, we're good. Okay. Next question is, does the TOFCA top 20 high priority chemicals include the first top 10 chemicals?
It does not, no. So if the question is, do those, the three chemicals that I showed, do they represent the top tier? Is that the question? And if it is the question, then no, we sort of picked a subset of the chemicals that kind of are within the full range of the test set.
Okay. The next question is, ethyl acetate is quite volatile. How volatile is hydroxyethyl acetate?
It is somewhat volatile. I don't have the number off the top of my head right here, but I think it is somewhat volatile. And
okay, and next question coming in is, are these software freely available?
Yes, all of the software except Derek Nexus is freely available. Derek Nexus is a cost-based licensed product.
Okay. Another question is, how did you determine the physicochemical property exclusion criteria?
That's a good question. So we use professional judgment related to the adverse outcome pathway for skin sensitization, but we weren't too stringent here. We were purposely a bit broad to include kind of a wider set of chemicals. So we're trying to get, chemicals that are, roughly similar in terms of physicochemical properties, but not, identical. And part of that was to kind of see how stringent we have to be. But also we have sort of a small test set of 28 chemicals here. So we wanted to have some chemicals that showed up in our final list of potential surrogates, which, by the way, is also the case kind of in real read-across scenarios where, you oftentimes don't have data for a chemical that is, nearly identical to the target chemical you're looking at. So I think that's something that, we could look into further. What happens if you tighten up these exclusion criteria a little bit, how does that affect things? It presumably will make things better, but then you may not have any surrogates to choose from.
Thank you. Next question is, have you ever looked at the publications for Aptula and Roberts? They classify the chemicals in the mechanistic domains.
Can you repeat the question? I'm sorry.
Have you looked at the publications for Apchela and Roberts? They classify the chemicals in mechanistic domains.
Yes, I do think that we've looked at that. And there's a lot more that can be done with read-across in terms of justification, you know, in terms of mechanistic studies or even metabolism studies. And so that kind of goes to this question of, you know, how much justification do you need given different scenarios? And so we are familiar with that work and considering, you know, kind of different ways to that one might bolster a read-across assessment for different, you know, scenarios such as regulation or you know, alternative assessment.
Okay, another question came in. With the chemical that was shown to be a non-skin sensitizer, how certain is it that the chemical might be highly toxic in another organ?
That's a very good question. So we really are not saying here that that chemical is non-toxic, is generally non-toxic. That's, you know, that's definitely not what we're saying here. In this case, you know, we were tasked with just looking at the sensitization potential of that chemical. We do work with other companies where we assess the hazard of chemicals for different endpoints, but for this study, we didn't do that.
Okay, it looks like while we're waiting on more people to submit some questions, let's go to the phone lines. If you would like to ask a question, please take yourself off of mute by pressing #6, state your name and organization, and ask your question, and then you can remute yourself by pressing *6. If anybody on the phone line would like to ask a question, again, #6 takes yourself off of mute. Okay, hearing no other questions, thank you again, Dr. Rice, for a great presentation. Next, we will hear from Dr. Aaron Baker. Dr. Baker is a bioanalytical chemist with more than 18 years' experience and more than 100 publications utilizing ion mobility spectrometry in conjunction with mass spectrometry to study environmental and biological systems. In the last 12 years, she has worked primarily to develop high-throughput multidimensional analyses to quickly study numerous samples in a short time period without losing valuable information. Dr. Baker is also working with various informatics teams to design and implement software tools that automatically analyze these complex data sets. Dr. Baker, I will now turn it over to you.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Perfect. So I'm really excited to present today. I think this is a great opportunity to showcase what we've been doing. And also, like Dr. Rice, I love our ability to collaborate with other people to get better tools, especially in the analytical scenario that people can actually use for their research. I'd also like to thank the Superfund for inviting me to present today. So like many of you on the phone, we're very interested in understanding health risks and what causes one person to get a disease while the other person doesn't get the disease. In these cases, you have to know what a person is exposed to in their specific external environment. What do they eat? Do they smoke? Do they exercise? What kind of germs are they exposed to? Those all filter into your health risks. We also have to know your general external environmental health risks, such as where do you live? Are you in a highly polluted area? Or are you in a nice green space where you're just sniffing the trees? But if you're allergic to these trees, that also has adverse health risks. And then finally, how do these specific external and general external environments affect your internal environment, such as the chemicals that are doing your metabolism and all types of different activities that are going on in your body? And so we roll those up and look at the health risks from each of those components. How we do this, being an analytical chemist, is we do multi-omic analyses. So we start with a blood sample or a soil sample or a water sample, depending on what type of system we're interested in studying, do the genomics of that sample, the transcriptomics of that sample, the proteomics, the glycomics, the lipidomics, the metabolomics, and the exposomics. But this causes all kinds of different measurements to occur. We also know that from the Human Genome Project that greater than 90% of diseases are not due solely to genetics. So we need to do all these different measurements really to figure out why certain people are having adverse health risks. Because I'm a mass spectrometrist, I've focused more in the area in the circle. So in the later stages, because a lot of these molecules are the first ones to go up because they're what you're being exposed to and what occurs with your metabolism, where sometimes it takes the genomics a little bit longer to change due to your exposures. So we're going to focus more on the right-hand side today in my talk. So focusing on the right-hand side, we're looking more at small molecule measurements. And so the problem with small molecules, though, is there's many challenges in their measurements. The first main challenge is that they can occur from very low to very high concentrations. So you need instruments that are very, very sensitive to get those lowly occurring molecules. But then you also want to know some of the high exposures. So you need instruments with high dynamic range, so you're detecting both the low concentration molecules and the high concentration molecules at the same time. We also need to understand the molecules that are naturally occurring in the body and the molecules such as the xenobiotics that you're being exposed to if you're injecting yourself with testosterone or if you're smoking. So we need to know how these change with the exposure of the xenobiotics. The third challenge is that a lot of people try to do untargeted measurements where they're looking at every single small molecule possible, but there can be thousands of different small molecules that you're exposed to or that are occurring in your body. Like you have your glucose that's naturally occurring in your body and glycolysis, but then you also have the shampoo you're putting on your head and all the different cosmetics you're putting on your face, including lotions, that you're also going to detect in your measurements. And then the other problem that we run into with mass spectrometry is that many of the small molecules have the exact same masses, but completely different chemical makeup. So it's very difficult to distinguish them with mass spec-based approaches, and some of them are impossible to distinguish. So just for an example of this, if you look at testosterone, there, if you just look in the NIST database, there's 18 different options that have the exact same mass as testosterone. So if you're doing mass spectrometry and looking at masses, you don't know which one of these 18 different molecules that you're actually detecting in a system. However, there's different approaches that you can use to discriminate these molecules. And if you look at these different structures, we can see that the testosterone structure on the left is much different than the three other molecules on the right. And that's when we got into my approach, which is called ion, and it's not my approach, the approach that I'm using, called ion mobility spectrometry. And in ion mobility spectrometry, we can combine that with mass spectrometry and learn about the structure of the molecule at the exact same time as we look at the mass of the molecule. So in ion mobility spectrometry, what you do is it's opposite of mass spectrometry. In mass spectrometry, you take a tube and you pump all the molecules out of it so that when the molecules that you're interested in go into it, they don't have any collisions as they're going to the detector. In ion mobility, though, we try and fill that tube full of as many buffer gas molecules as we can, and we use something like helium or nitrogen, some kind of inert buffer gas, and then we inject our molecules in a pulse into that buffer gas. The molecules race, basically, to the end because you pull them through with a very weak electric field, and the ones that are smaller go through the drift cell faster because they don't have as many collisions with the buffer gas. And the ones that are more extended or larger come through slower, so we can learn which molecules have a more extended conformation type. And so in this case, we have a molecule with a meta orientation of its hydroxyl groups and a molecule with a para orientation of the hydroxyl groups. When we inject those into the drift cell, we can see that the one with meta is a little bit less extended, so it gets through the drift cell faster than the one with para, so I can tell you that these have the exact same mass, but our hydroxyl groups have different orientations. what ion mobility gives you, because you're using this ion neutral collisional space, is it gives you a cross section. And this gives you the shape of the molecule. So it's basically measuring the area of the molecule as it's going through this drift tube, and then adds a little additional space based on the collisions it's having with the buffer gas. The nice thing about this is it's only dependent on the buffer gas you use, the pressure of your buffer gas, and the length of your tube. So it's comparable easy between labs. So I can use the same instrument as somebody in Europe, and we can get the exact same values. This allows us to transfer SOPs to each lab and actually look at the exact, or get the same results, no matter where we're using the instrument. The nice thing about ion mobility, because some people might say, well, I can do this with chromatography or other types of solution-based approaches, or even gas chromatography. But ion mobility, because it occurs in the gas phase, only takes milliseconds for the molecules to go through the drift tube. So unlike chromatography that takes minutes to hours, we can do this structural analysis coupled with mass spec in just milliseconds. We can also do multidimensional analyses where we put an LC in front of our ion mobility, in front of our mass spec, and do three dimensions, and then fourth dimension is the intensity. So this gives you lots of different information about each molecule you're analyzing in your experiment. However, our goal is to get rid of the front stage chromatography, because we know that with these different health assessments, we're going to have to run thousands and thousands of different samples. So it's not feasible for us to do 30 minutes to an hour per sample. We want to do something where we can do seconds per sample, so we can screen through the patient population and maybe pick subgroups to do more extended analyses. So one example of where we've used the ion mobility with the mass spectrometry is looking at different isomers in glycolysis. And an isomer is just a molecule that has the exact same molecular weight as another. So in this case, fructose-6-phosphate, glucose-6-phosphate, and glucose-1-phosphate all have the exact same masses. So in mass spectrometry, you would just know that one of the three is there. However, when we run it through the ion mobility, as you can see on the bottom, they separate by different structures, because the fructose has a 5-membered ring instead of the 6-membered ring of the glucose-6-phosphate and the glucose-1-phosphate. The different phosphate positions allow the 6-phosphate and the 1-phosphate to separate, though, and we can even pull those apart. We've also started using these on different xenobiotic-type molecules in collaboration with Carrie Hornbuckle's group, and we've looked at different types of PCBs where the chlorines are at different positions, and we can easily separate many of the different types of PCBs. She was also looking at the hydroxylated versions of the PCBs to understand how they were metabolized, and we've been able to pull those apart too when the hydroxyl groups are at different positions, probably indicating that the parent molecule that has been metabolized is a separate parent molecule. Because this is a newer technique, it actually has been around since the 80s, but commercially available instruments have only been coming out since the early 2000s. We wanted to make sure that our measurements were very precise and that this would work within different labs throughout the whole world. And so we did an inter-lab comparison of the values we were getting in our instrument, and we looked at 80 different molecules going from metabolites, lipids, peptides, and proteins. And we looked at their collision cross-section numbers through our ion mobility system. With these, we did this with Agilent Technologies, which is where our system is being sold from. And then also we compared that to a group in Vanderbilt that had this exact same system, and then a group at BOKU in Vienna, Austria. When the four different labs ran triplicate injections of the different molecules, we ran them in positive and negative mode, and what we saw was a relative standard deviation of 0.4% between the different labs for all 80 molecules. So we were really excited about this, because a lot of chromatography results are usually above 1% to 2% RSDs. And with chromatography, your material and your columns degrade throughout time, so you have to worry about changes with time. With ion mobility, all it depends on is the length of your drift tube, which is set, your buffer gas pressure, which we use a flow controller, so everybody puts in the same flow controller measurements, and then the temperature of your lab, and that's also controlled for in the measurements. The other thing we worried about was sample reproducibility if we had mixtures instead of just pure standards. So in collaboration with Yvonne Rusin's group, we sent three different samples between Texas A&M and Pacific Northwest National Lab, and you can see how reproducible the measurements were for the different mixtures in two different instruments, but the same type of instrument. So finally, what we wanted to do is we wanted to find a way to automate the sample injection if we are receiving thousands of different samples so that we can get them run and screened very quickly. So we found an automated solid phase extraction system to help us out with this process. You can just do auto-injection, but some of the samples, such as urine that we were doing, had high concentrations of salt. So if we could do the solid phase extraction, we could remove that salt and just send the molecules straight to the mass spectrometer and not have to do so much time in extractions. So in this approach, the solid phase extraction cartridge could be any packing material that you would use in LC or liquid chromatography, and then you would inject your sample into this SPE cartridge. And you can see we have a blue type of molecule and a green type of molecule. We'll say that the green type of molecules are our salts. And so we wash our cartridge with a certain type of solvent, and only the blue molecules stick to the cartridge while our salts go through the cartridge and flush right through to the waistline, and we don't have to worry about analyzing them. Then we reverse our flow and send everything that's bound to the cartridge to the mass spectrometer. And this process only takes 10 seconds from sample injection to mass spec analysis. So the 10 second, or a sample will elute in 3 seconds. The other 7 seconds are used for the cartridge re-equilibration and for injection of the next sample. And you can see on the bottom left-hand side, we washed our system for 1 minute, and then we did 6 injections in the next minute. And the peaks are very reproducible. This was 6 different urine injections. What that gives us is we can see, in this case, we're looking for polar molecules in mouse plasma and then also polar molecules in human urine. And you can see all the different types of molecules we're picking up in just a 3-second analysis, basically, of the sample, but with 10-second sample-to-sample injections. We're getting about 1,400 features on the left-hand side and 1,000 features on the right-hand side. And if you look at the mass spectrum, which is on the left side of the black plots, you can see how the molecules vary between plasma and urine. So we are picking up quite a few different types of molecules in the different matrices. With the ion mobility, what we found, though, is because we're losing any type of other separation, we could find structural isomers easily within these groups of features, where we could determine how many molecules had that exact same mass and whether they were smaller or larger. We also could look at ones that have similar masses but were just slightly separated, and you can see that in the urine on the right side. The SPE also helped us get better limits of detection for our instrument. So before we used the SPE, we were having trouble with some of those salts interfering with some of our low concentration molecules. As soon as we removed these salts in urine, what we could do is get down to about 500 picomolar for limits of detection. If you're used to picograms per mil, it would be similar to 500 picograms per mil and maybe even a little bit better, and at very linear calibration curves for these types of molecules. So what we've created is a small molecule pipeline, where we usually do some type of rough extraction prior to running our instrumental analyses. And we laugh that for a person, we can do about 100 samples per day in this extraction approach. If you have robots, you can do way more. But then we go into our instrumental analyses, and we can actually run 8,200 samples per day. So it's a great screening approach for screening samples. However, we worry about data processing and analysis because we know that this can be the most time-consuming step. So my group has really worked on trying to find possible matches for these features that we're detecting in our instrument in a quick way. So we've made, because I've shown you earlier that there's such good reproducibility between different groups throughout the world, we've made a collision cross-section database that we can share with anybody using ion mobility spectrometry, and that they can figure out what type of molecules are there based on what's in the database. There could be some that aren't in the database, but we're trying to populate this database as we're adding new standards as they come available to us. This is my postdoc on the right. She's done a great job, and she started off looking at just normal endogenous molecules such as lipids, peptides, nucleotides, and oligosaccharides, and she saw great trends, which has also been shown by John McLean's group in Vanderbilt, where nucleotides and oligosaccharides are the smallest type of molecule because they're more ring-bound, have very ring-based structures. Peptides have a linear backbone, but it has carbon and nitrogen in the backbone, so it's a little bit more flexible than lipids that have carbon-carbon backbones. So what we've been doing is we've been adding small molecules to these measurements and looking for similar trends in the small molecules. She's done about 600 small molecules right now, and we're just adding them as we get them. The reason it's taken us a while to do those is we make sure that we have very good values. We do triplicate measurements for every molecule in both positive and negative mode so that we look at the RSD in intralab, and then we also look at other labs that have done them, and so the RSD intralab. We've been able to cover different metabolic pathways, so we've looked at all the molecules in glycolysis, the pentose phosphate pathway, the TCA pathway, and the urea cycle. And so we have these. We went back to understanding the different trend lines of these small molecules or primary metabolites, and you have your amino acids, your nucleotides, and your steroids that you see in protonated forms. And you can see that each different type of molecule has very specific trend lines, so it's easy to determine what the molecule type is. This allows us to look at unknown molecules that we have, fit those to trend lines, and we learn more about their backbone structure and whether they're more amino acid-like, nucleotide-like, or steroid-like. We've also done these with deprotonation and with adducts, such as different salts, sodium, potassium, and ammonium. And with the deprotonated forms, you can see that there's more clustering between the different molecule types. But if you look at the different structures, again, what we have are the sugars and the nucleotides cluster together because they're ring-based. The lipid mediators and the fatty acids cluster together because they're carbon-carbon backbone-based. And our fatty acids cluster in a different area. So we can start learning more about unknown features. And we have people at PNNL working on doing theoretical calculations whether what type of molecule would be, if you had an unknown, what type of backbone you would expect the unknown to have. We've also started doing xenobiotic trend lines. So we've looked at PBDEs, PCBs, and PAHs, and we found very specific trend lines for those too. So when we start looking at our xenobiotics, we can determine what type of molecule they are without even with doing these rapid analyses and without having to do longer assays for them. Then if you have a sample where maybe you have a urine sample and you might have an herbicide mixed with an amino acid, we can separate those two, and we see great distinction between a molecule such as tyrosine and glyphosphonate, which have very similar masses but completely different structures. And you can see on the bottom, ion mobility pulls the structural separation completely apart, allowing us to identify which molecule is which. So finally, what we've set up is a website at PNNL where we have all this structural information for these metabolites and xenobiotics available to anybody that's interested in looking at this information for possibly theoretical uses or experimental uses, and they can download all the cross-sections at the little download data button on the right. So if you have an ion mobility instrument, you can start running analyses just like that, or if you're interested in learning about unknowns, we can run samples and learn what group they might fit into. And so in summary, our ion mobility spectrometry, because it's gas phase-based, it enables us to do a rapid structural analyses that we can combine with mass spectrometry and learn more information about as many molecules that we can detect in our samples. By combining these ion mobility spectrometry separations with solid phase extractions and mass spec, we're able to get faster and better small molecule identifications and learn more about the unknowns that we aren't even able to identify. And so I'd really like to thank Agilent Technologies, who's helped me a lot with my research and doing these new approaches. I also had an R01 through NIHS, so they've funded a lot of work that we've done here. And we're funded by the Superfund, the TAMU Superfund, which is a P42. We also have had money from the NIH GM Sciences and money from PNNL and the Environmental Molecular Science Building, which is where I'm housed. So I'd really like to thank you all for your attention. And any questions that I can help with, I'd be happy to.
Thank you, Dr. Baker. Just a reminder, you can submit questions in the Q&A pod in the lower right-hand corner. So we'll start off with one of the questions that came through. What are some of the challenges with current ion mobility measurements?
So some of the problems is that if the molecules are too similar in structure, it is difficult for us to separate them. And sometimes we never know if this will occur until we run the experiment. So sometimes we just have to do it to see how hard the molecules are to separate. But we're working on new techniques now to do better ion mobility separations and separate those molecules that are difficult to distinguish right now.
Okay. And what fragmentation databases do you find the most useful, and are there any free databases that you use, for example, on NIST?
So that's a good question. I use a lot of the Metlin databases by Gary Susdak's group, and then we also have been working a lot with David Wishart and getting as many of his databases as possible to utilize, because he has some great exposure databases that are coming out. They've come out in about the last couple years.
Have you done xenobiotic trend lines for PFASs, and how do they respond in IMS-MS?
So that's actually our next experiment, so I'm really excited to do that. That's we just finished our PBDE work and our PAH and our PCB, and so now we want to do PFAS and see how they match with the other ones, too, as far as trend lines.
Will it be possible to use ion mobility to characterize the chiral contaminants?
So we've been doing some work with that, too, just recently. And sometimes in ion mobility, you can't distinguish some of the chiral contaminants. But what we've found is that we can adduct those to different molecules that actually have a chiral center. So we've been working with cyclodextrins with chirals. And it's a chiral cyclodextrin that we add to our samples, and that will actually bind in different ways to different chiral molecules because it's chiral itself. And we're seeing huge separations sometimes between different chiral molecules that we weren't able to separate alone without the chiral cyclodextrin.
Okay, while we give some more time to put some questions in the Q&A pod, I'd like to go to the phone lines. As a reminder, you can ask a question by turning your phone off of mute by pressing #6. And then re-mute yourself by pressing *6. Any questions on the phone? Another one came in from the Q&A pod. Regarding protonated versus deprotonated forms, does that mean that the substrates all have pKa's?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they definitely do. And that will... Usually in the solution, we'll add a little bit of salt or a little bit of acid or a little bit of base sometimes to make those work better in different modes. So we do a lot of our ion mobility analyses in both positive polarity and in negative polarity. And if we want to see something in negative, you might add a little bit of ammonium hydroxide just to make them work a little bit better. And in positive, sometimes we add a little bit of formic acid or acetic acid just to see them better. But, yeah, they definitely do have pKa's.
Anyone on the phone would like to ask a question? #6 to unmute yourself. Or any other questions from Question Pod?
Hey, Brittany, can you hear me?
Hello?
Yep, we can hear you, whoever that was. Okay, can you still hear me? Because I think I pressed another button. I don't know if I muted myself again.
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, thank you. This is Michelle Heacock from NIEHS. I just had a quick question for you, Erin. I was intrigued by your your SPE system where you were trying to automate it, and you were flushing it out, flushing out some of the salts. Do you periodically just check that waistline to make sure you're not inadvertently flushing out some of the things you might want to test, like maybe some of the molecules are coming off with the salts?
Yep, and that's a really good question, because it's easy if you don't optimize the solvent that you're using for the flushing to flush off too much. And so we do test that. We'll catch the flow through and run that through the instrument and see what's in the flow through. Sometimes that's almost bad because you are washing your instrument with some salt sometimes, but we think it's important to know when we're losing things. Another approach we use, too, is we'll buy label the standards of the molecules we're really, really interested in. If we're really interested in a certain pesticide, we'll try to find a C13 labeled version of it, and we'll run that through the system to make sure that the solvent that we're using doesn't flush that into the waistline, and make sure that we have a really good signal, and that makes us confident that when we run the real sample, that we'll also be seeing the molecule that's not C13 labeled. Sometimes we also spike in the C13 labels to determine the abundance of the unlabeled versions too, because we can do the ratio of the labeled to the unlabeled to determine their absolute quantitation.
A couple more questions have come through the pod. Have these techniques been useful in profiling biomarkers of disease?
So that's our goal. We've done it for proteomics. That was in my earlier studies at PNNL, and we're trying to do it for more metabolomic-based studies right now. What we're finding is a lot of times our biomarkers are unknowns instead of the target. We find target molecules, but sometimes those aren't disease-specific. You'll find, like, glucose is really high in diabetics, which isn't surprising. But glucose can also be high in cancer patients and others, and so you can't usually use glucose as a biomarker. But we'll find unknown molecules that are very statistically significant within specific disease groups and not other disease groups. So we're working on classifying what these are. The problem with small molecule measurements right now is that there's only about 10,000 standards available, and we're detecting so many more molecules than that. So we know that there's a lot of importance in the molecules that we don't know what they are exactly.
Could you provide the website of the metabolomics database again?
I can go back to that slide. That might be the easiest.
Yeah.
It's right there. Yeah, so the website's at the top. It's at http://panomics.pnnl.gov/metabolites. And then it was also published in our recent paper in Chemical Science, if people are interested in learning about how we created the database and what we learned from the database creation.
And let's see. Anyone else on the phone that couldn't get yourself off of mute? Okay, well, it looks like we'll have plenty of time at the end for questions for everyone. So thank you again, Dr. Baker. And we will switch over to Dr. Chris Volpe. Dr. Volpe is a professor at the University of Florida, Gainesville, in the Center for Environmental and Human Toxicology. Dr. Volpe's group uses systems-level approaches in eukaryotes from yeast to people to identify the functional components that respond to and modulate the consequences of environmental stressors. Currently, his laboratory has been utilizing genome-wide CRISPR screens to understand the mechanisms of toxicity of environmental chemicals. Dr. Volpe is an author or a co-author on more than 125 papers in peer-reviewed journals and books. He received his MD and PhD from the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Volpe, I'll now turn it over to you.
Okay, thank you very much. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, well, first I just wanted to thank the Superfund program for inviting me to talk. And I'm going to talk today about a new emerging tool that's being developed that can potentially help us understand the risk and hazard of chemicals. I think that it fits in well to the previous talks in terms of, you know, how do we address the large number of chemical contaminants that are present in
the environment and evaluate their risk in a cost-effective way. So this is my overview of how we previously dealt with questions of toxicity. And so in the old school sort of idea that there was a toxicant, and we didn't really have a good understanding of what's going on inside the organism or the cell, and ultimately that resulted in what I would call bad stuff. And we used this relationship between toxicant exposure and bad stuff in an attempt to do risk assessment. And more recently, there's been an effort to try to put some mechanistic underpinnings to risk assessment. Something you're probably familiar with is the development of so-called adverse outcome pathways. And the overall goal with this approach is to try to fill in that black box with some mechanism or mode of action, try to identify the molecular initiating events and the subsequent biologic effects on an organism, I guess in the hope that this is going to improve risk assessment. One of the challenges, though, as sort of pointed out by the first speakers, is the enormous number of chemicals that are out there. And the reality is that we know very little about the vast majority of chemicals. So putting in and coming up with a mechanism or mode of action for a chemical is very challenging. And as a result, the use of this sort of approach is difficult in the absence of mechanistic information. So I'm going to talk today about one approach that we've been working on, as well as other people, to try to fill in those mechanistic gaps. And the approach is based on what I call a functional approach in toxicology. And essentially, this is not a new idea. This is an idea that's been around for a long time. And the idea is essentially that if you muck up a gene, you mutate it, and then you see what the functional effect is of mucking up the gene, and if that mutation results in a change in the organismal or cell response to a toxicant, then you can conclude or infer that gene has a functional importance in response to a toxicant. What we're doing differently now is that previously this effort was largely focused on a single gene by gene analysis. For instance, making knockout mice and looking at what the effect is of knocking out a particular gene is in a mouse, and then asking in that knockout mouse, how does that change the response to a particular toxicant? And this approach has given an enormous insight into the functional role of many different genes and gene products and the relationship with toxicant exposure. The idea that's been made possible by some new technology, which I will describe in a minute, is the ability to do this in a systematic way. So rather than going on an individual gene-by-gene basis, recent technical capabilities has made it possible to systematically test many genes at the same time for their role in toxicity. By essentially mutating their function or perturbing, mutating the gene and thus perturbing their function. So by doing this, you can systematically assess what are the important genes and consequently the important functionally relevant biological processes and pathways involved in modulating toxicity. So I'm going to illustrate this in a sort of generic cell here, where you can imagine a cell with a being exposed to a toxicant, and the toxicant has to get into the cell. It is transported through the cell, metabolized, producing various metabolites. Those metabolites could potentially interact with sort of cellular targets, and those cellular interactions with those cellular targets could result in the adverse effects on the cell. There also could be appropriate stress response in terms of trying to deal with that toxicant, or methods to export the compound out of the cell. So the idea is that for any given toxicant, these biologic processes are taking place. But how do you identify them for a toxicant that you don't know anything about? In the past, it's been a very grueling process of systematic molecular biology, and where you go on an individual basis and assess the role of individual genes and try to figure out if they're important, follow clues, and slowly piece the overall picture together. So our idea with functional toxicology is that rather than doing it individually, the idea is that you can mutate all of the genes that are potentially involved and see what the effect is on toxicity. So in this example, in this hypothetical example, we've mutated a gene involved in toxicant import. And in this case, you would expect that this would decrease the cellular toxicity of that toxicant because it's not able to enter the cell. In this other case, there is a mutation in one of the cellular stress response pathway genes that are involved in dealing with the toxicity caused by this toxicant. And as a result, this could result in increased cellular toxicity. So this just gives you kind of an overview of sort of the conceptual framework that we're using to try to use functional toxicology to understand adverse outcome pathways. So how do we actually do this? Well, as I mentioned, the advent of new technologies, specifically CRISPR, has allowed us to systematically assess the function of genes. Now, you're probably familiar with individual targeted CRISPR, but for those who are not, I'll just give a very brief introduction. Essentially, it's a method that allows you to target an individual gene of interest and to functionally inactivate it using a specific nuclease called Cas9, which is directed to the site of interest through a specific targeting sgRNA. The Cas9 then goes to that targeting site, it cuts the DNA, double-stranded break, and then the normal repair mechanisms of the organism try to repair that. Cas9, though, is relentless, and it just keeps cutting it until the organism makes a mistake and puts in a mutation. So this mutation now then is propagated. And not only is Cas9 relentless, but it also attacks both alleles. So you get a functional knockout of in that organism or cell. And this approach has really revolutionized the capability of people and molecular biologists to do functional knockouts, whereas before using homologous recombination, it was an incredibly arduous and long process, and you could generally only target a single allele. So this is really is being used now by toxicologists to assess function and their role and the role of genes in toxicology quite broadly. But I'm going to focus not on the sort of individual use of CRISPR, but on an alternative approach, which is what's called genome-wide CRISPR, where rather than looking at a single gene, you look at a whole large number of genes at the same time. And it's essentially exactly the same, but rather than using just a single targeting sgRNA, targeting a specific gene, you are simultaneously targeting multiple genes. But what you do is you actually target each gene individually in one cell. So you generate a mutant pool where you have a single gene knocked out in a single cell. So, and after you do this, you have now generated a pool of mutants in which a single gene has been knocked out in one cell. But together, you have representations of a knockout of all the genes. So once you've done this, now you can use this to try to identify the genes which are actually important in response to the toxicant. And I'll sort of illustrate that now in the next slides. So how do you do this, actually? Well, you first have to design the sgRNA to the gene of interest. And this is a computational process right now. And you generate these sgRNAs. They're then cloned into a lentivirus. You generate a pool plasmid library, which then is used, which is then packaged into lentivirus and used to infect cells. You can do this. You can do your own custom library, or these libraries are now commercially available from places such as AdGene, and there's a large number of genome-wide libraries available for multiple species, human, mouse, Drosophila. So it's quite easy to get these. So now you've got this library. How do you make your mutant knockout library? So you take your pooled library, which contains sgRNAs targeted to every gene. You now make this lentiviral pool. And now here's the real trick, and that what you do is that you introduce these targeting constructs at a low multiplicity of infection. And what that means is that you're only getting less than one or one virus, at most one virus per cell, so that in each cell, a different gene is being knocked out. And that's sort of illustrated there, in that each cell is containing one single sgRNA, and the ones that don't receive anything, you actually remove by using an antibiotic selection. So now you're left with a targeted library. You're now left with a targeted library that can individual cell contains a single knockout, and each cell contains a different knockout. So what's particularly interesting, though, or particularly useful, is that these lentivirus actually integrate into the genome, and as a result, they act as a barcode for the knockout itself, and they uniquely identify the cell containing the corresponding knockout. And so this allows you to go back and quantitate the effect of any particular exposure. And I'll explain that in the next slide. So the idea is that you take your mutant knockout library now, where you have a representation of every gene knocked out, and that's just shown here for three genes, and you are exposing, you now grow those in your abuse of choice, which would be a toxicant, and you either do it in an unexposed situation, the control, or in a treatment. Now, in the control, in a usual situation, there's no change in the amount of each of these mutants. However, in the case of the treatment, if a particular gene affects the ability of the cell to deal with that toxicant, it can result in either a growth advantage, for instance, what I had shown before, maybe preventing import into the cell, or a growth disadvantage. Now these cells are at a disadvantage. They can't deal with the toxicant stress as well. And so you can now determine and go back and figure out which are the ones that are at an advantage or disadvantage by taking advantage of these barcodes. And essentially what you do is that you amplify up the barcodes, which are the sgRNAs corresponding to each mutant, and you amplify them up using PCR, and then you just sequence them. You sequence the sgRNAs and count how many sgRNAs there are of each corresponding to each knockout. So in this case, here are the controls, and in this case, there's more of the cells corresponding to this knockout, which indicates that this knockout is resistant to the toxicant exposure. This one doesn't care if the toxicant is there. This knockout doesn't affect the response to the toxicant. And in this case, this knockout here is actually sensitive. So what this allows you to do is to systematically and simultaneously determine the importance of every gene in the genome for a response to the toxicant. I'm going to now give you some specific examples of how this has been used in some published and unpublished work. So the first is a published study, and in this study they looked at the genes involved in response to paraquat. And their study used a particular cell line called the GERCAT cell lines, and they used a knockout library which corresponded to around 3,000 genes. And these were 3,000 genes that they specifically chose that were related to metabolism. And so they, as I said, what they did is they now made this library or mutant library of knockouts, and they either left them alone, didn't treat them, or they treated them with paraquat. And in the case for looking at the resistance genes, they treated them at around the inhibitory concentration of IC50. So a normal cell without a mutation, essentially 50% of the cells are going to croak at this concentration. And they exposed it to paraquat, and they let it go for 14 days. And so what's happening during this time is that the cells that are sensitive are dying faster than in the untreated, and the cells that are resistant are going to grow faster than in the untreated. And so you now, at the end of this, you then harvest the DNA from both of these and count the abundance of each sgRNA using sequencing. And what they found, as illustrated here, is they just ranked the top 25 resistant genes and found, interestingly enough, POR, which is involved in cytochrome oxidase metabolism, a gene involved in copper metabolism, were resistant to paraquat. They confirmed the role of these genes by doing individual knockouts, confirming that the genome-wide screen had actually had identified the gene correctly. So they further evaluated this and found that the POR is important in the production of ROS during the exposure to paraquat. In the absence of POR, you actually greatly decrease the intercellular ROS levels and the production of hydrogen peroxide. So again, this demonstrates and revealed a really important mechanistic process by which paraquat leads to its detrimental effects. They said did a separate screen where they were looking for things that made the cells sensitive to paraquat, and intriguingly, they identified several genes involved in copper metabolism, including the CTR1 gene, which is involved in copper uptake, as well as a gene which probably most people are familiar with, superoxide dismutase, which is also which is involved in dealing with ROS production. These are connected by because CTR1 is a copper transporter and SOD is a copper zinc using enzyme, and they subsequently confirmed that, in fact, copper deficiency contributes to toxicity in response to paraquat. So by this study, they've been able to make some important insights into the roles and into the mechanism of paraquat. Now I'm going to go on to some of the work from my own laboratory, where we did a similar sort of approach, but the question that we were focused on is trying to get insight into the effects of arsenic and what are the genes that are involved in arsenic toxicity. And I think most people would agree that the mechanism of arsenic toxicity is quite controversial, and there are many different potential mechanisms that have been identified, and we wanted to see if this approach could provide some either additional, provide some clarification, or potentially add to the confusion. So we carried out a screen using a whole genome CRISPR study, identified a series of genes which were involved in sensitivity or resistance. And in this study, what you can see here is these individual genes that were knocked out. You can look at how abundant that knockout was in the screen in the treated versus the control. So for instance, knocking out KEAP1 made the organism, made the cell more resistant to arsenic trioxide. You identify quite a large number of candidate genes. I've only shown the top 10. And in order to validate them, we carried out a secondary screen where we actually did it the entire screen over again, but selected candidates and did additional sgRNAs for each gene. And through this secondary confirmatory screen, we identified a more limited number of genes which showed sensitivity or resistance. What did these results show? So I just give a brief list of some of the genes that are resistant and sensitive, and I'll explain them in more detail. I just wanted to illustrate here, these are the results for each individual sgRNA, and you can see that different sgRNAs targeting the same gene in many cases give very similar results. And the fact that you see multiple sgRNAs targeting the same gene giving you the same result increases your confidence that in fact this is a real result. So we did this and found several unexpected processes involved in response to arsenic. In particular, we found selenoprotein synthesis and incorporation into proteins, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. And not unexpectedly, we found a role for oxidative stress, which I'll briefly discuss. So the arsenic trioxide, we found that knocking out KEAP1 increased the resistance to arsenic trioxide. This is not surprising since KEAP1 inhibits NRF2, and NRF2 is the primary transcriptional response factor involved in dealing with oxidative stress. So removing KEAP1 basically causes the NRF2 to be constantly on, and this likely explains the knockout result of KEAP1 increasing the resistance to arsenic trioxide. We also identified several genes involved in likely involved in arsenic transport. If you knocked out aquaporin 3, that increased resistance, and knocking out MRP1 increased sensitivity, suggesting roles for these genes in the transport of arsenic. One of the most intriguing things, though, is that we found that actually selenocysteine metabolism appears to be involved in susceptibility to arsenic trioxide. And somewhat surprising, knockout of almost any gene involved in selenocysteine metabolism resulted in increased resistance to arsenic trioxide. And we confirmed this with individual knockouts, showing, in fact, yes, that just knocking out one of these genes increased resistance to arsenic trioxide. It was somewhat counterintuitive because many of these proteins are involved in response to oxidative stress, so we would have almost expected the opposite. So we have sort of a couple of hypotheses to explain this, and the one that we're that I'm just going to talk about here briefly is the idea of a selenium arsenic complex. And this is actually it's actually quite well known that selenium arsenic can actually form a mutually protective interaction and can form a physical complex. And this was actually noted back in 1938. And interestingly enough, arsenic exposure can prevent selenium poisoning, and alternatively, selenium can prevent arsenic poisoning. And it's been shown that these complexes may also play a role inside a cell. And so we hypothesize that by getting rid of selenocysteine incorporation into selenoproteins, we're actually increasing the intracellular selenium concentration, and that the increased intracellular selenium concentration could increase the formation of arsenic-selenium complexes, which then potentially could be exported out of the cells. And in support of this, actually just adding exogenous selenium decreased the effect of arsenic. I think we can see from those two examples that the use of this technology can help sort of fill in some of the gaps. And so where do I see this going in the future? And I'm trying to illustrate that here in that, I've just given an example from two toxicants, but we could potentially apply this in a more systematic approach for many different toxicants and try to identify the key sets of genes that are involved in response to a toxicant and use this information to start filling in these gaps and determining what are the biological pathways and processes that are involved in the response of a toxicant and how it leads to adverse outcomes. I believe this is a tool in our armamentarium to be able to help understand the effects of toxicants. I think the other approach, which is similar to one of the things that could be used, that's being used for gene expression profiling, is that you can also infer the mode of action by doing this functional profiling. So the idea here is that if you have two toxicants that share a functional requirement for particular genes, this would suggest that these two toxicants have similar modes of action. Similarly, once this sort of work has been done on reference toxicants where we know something about the mode of action, for instance, toxicants which cause for instance, maybe oxidative stress, we could sort of identify the functional requirements that are common for that mode of action, and then identify those, and then take an unknown toxicant, and by looking at the set of genes that are required for dealing with that toxicant, we could infer whether it has a mode of action more similar to the purple toxicant or the green toxicant. So I see this as a potential way to help understand the mode of action of unknown toxicants. And I think once we build up enough of a database of toxicants where we've started to work out the functional requirements, we'll be able to rapidly take unknown toxicants to be able to help infer the mode of action. I just wanted to briefly mention an approach that we're developing in collaboration with Xuan Liu and Luping Zhang and Keith Hope at the EPA, and this is what we call the TOX CRISPR approach. And the idea here is that rather than doing an entire genome, we would potentially focus on the genes that are specifically known to be involved in response to toxicants. And in this case, we used liberally the genes that have already been identified through the S1500 gene set, as well as the Environmental Genome Project, an additional some genes that we added to this, to identify around 3,675 genes that are involved in toxicology. And the idea is that this potentially, by using this subset library, this could enable one more rapid screening. It's a well annotated and understood functional set, so we can infer toxicology, toxicant mode of action perhaps easily, and maybe make it easier to determine adverse outcomes. And we're just starting in the process of using this approach to try to understand the mode of action of toxicants. With that, I'd like to thank all of the people who've contributed. This is a collaboration with Luping Zhang at UC Berkeley. And most of the work was carried out that from my lab by a talented graduate student, Amin, in the lab. Also have collaborators from other institutions, but I didn't talk about their work here. And then with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Volpe. Just a reminder, you can submit questions to the Q&A box. We'll start off with this first one. While the CRISPR technique can identify the knockout gene that might affect the toxicity of a given cell type, i.e. stem, progenitor, differentiated, do you know if the gene is epigenetically suppressed, and is the cell biology the same, or is the toxicity the same?
I think you're, from what I understand from the question, certainly epigenetics can affect the function of an individual gene. CRISPR knockout of a gene isn't going to be able to address an epigenetic effect. Interestingly, though, there are approaches to look at epigenetics by either targeting the genome sites where the epigenetic modifications occur, or alternatively targeting the genes which are involved in epigenetic modification. So if I understood that question correctly, that is a limitation of a CRISPR approach in that it really won't address specifically if there's an ongoing epigenetic effect.
How does the CRISPR compare to knockdown approaches such as short interfering RNA or short hairpin RNA?
Those approaches are, I guess, a precursor to this approach, and they're conceptually very similar, but rather than actually targeting the DNA, they're usually targeting the mRNA. And lead to knock down rather than knock out of a particular gene. There have been some side-by-side comparisons of shRNA approaches and siRNA approaches and CRISPR to see if they identify the same set of genes. And I would currently, I think the jury is out because one study found that CRISPR was a lot better. Another study suggested that maybe the shRNA approach was more effective. So I think there is still a question that needs to be resolved.
Okay, well, we give some more time for people to type out their questions. I could open up the phone lines. Remember, you can take yourself off of mute by pressing #6. Looks like another question came through. How would you apply this approach to chemicals that are metabolized to their reactive form?
Right. Well, I mean, I think a general limitation of most in vitro studies, and it's certainly something that ToxCast has been struggling with for a long time, is the fact that most in vitro cell lines don't really do much metabolism. So, I mean, I think you have the same issues here. Approaches that people have used are using exogenous treatment with, for instance, using extracts, S9 extracts, where you actually set up the in vitro metabolism before the treatment. Other approaches that people have been trying to work on is trying to use cell lines which have more effective metabolism, like the HEPA RG system. But I think that this is a standard issue with many in vitro systems, is how do you deal with metabolism.
Is the Paraquat work that you presented in one of your references?
The Paraquat work is referenced directly on the slide with the Paraquat. This was the reference here.
Okay. Again, I'd like to open it up to the phone lines. As a reminder, press #6, take yourself off of mute. Okay, and since we have some time left, thank you again, Dr. Volpe. I would like to open it up for any final questions for any of the presenters. As you submit any final questions using the Q&A pod, please include to whom you're directing the question to. Okay. Seeing as there's no other questions, I wanted to make sure, and before we conclude, I wanted to make sure that everyone is aware of the related URL pod. It contains the seminar resources and seminar feedback links. On the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack, so in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentations as they were given today. Also, in the related URLs, you'll find the seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form because we do look at your comments as we try to continue to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in the event. So I'd like to remind the participants of the various ways that you can stay connected to ensure that you don't miss any future webinars. For more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the CLUIN.org website. You can also subscribe to their free monthly e-newsletter called Tech Direct and follow CLUIN on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. We also encourage that you visit our SRP Risky Learning webpage for information about any upcoming sessions, and you can also follow SRP on Twitter. I'd also like to encourage everyone to join us on May 31st at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for the third and final session of this series. This third session will focus on new and emerging strategies for chemical safety evaluation. This will include work to understand how in vivo, in vitro, and in silico models can address population variability, and how in vitro high-throughput assays can provide useful information for hazard assessment of complex mixtures. And the presenters include Bill Sook, the director of the Superfund Research Program, Wei-Shui Shu, leader of the Texas A&M SRP Center Decision Science Corps, and Michael DeVito, acting chief of the National Toxicology Program Laboratory. If you'd like to join the webinar, you can register now. And if you cannot attend, again, the archives will be made available after the event, so we encourage you to come back to these pages for the links and to the archives after the webinars are held. So with that, it's time to conclude today's webinar. If you submitted an online question after the fact, and we did not, well, looks like we answered all the questions, so we don't need to pass these along to the presenters. If you have any additional questions, you can contact the presenters via email, and they can be seen on the website. I would like to thank our presenters, Dr. Jim Rice, Dr. Aaron Baker, and Dr. Chris Volpe, for their time and for sharing the presentations with us today. And that concludes today's presentation. So thank you all for your participation and hanging in there with us and for asking all of your questions. Have a great day.